today with Danny Fuentes, who is the founder and owner of Lethal Amounts. It is a gallery space, clothing line. He's also a promoter. He's a designer. He hosts several of my favorite shows, art shows that I've seen here in Los Angeles, as well as done a lot of live performances that I've really enjoyed. Danny's an LA native. So why don't you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Lethal Amounts?
Hey, I'm Danny Fuentes. Lethal Amounts is my little baby. I don't know, it's a little bit of everything, but at the end of the day, it is an art gallery that promotes concerts and nightlife events and has a little clothing line attached to it and a lot of provocative history.
And the logo is very synonymous with Los Angeles. Obviously, it's based on the Dodgers. The Los Angeles Dodgers, for those of you who don't know who that is, but based on the Los Angeles Dodgers. So how did you come up with the two paperclip safety pins as your logo?
You could say it's a spoof on the LA Dodgers logo. I mean, being from LA, you tend to get a little bit of pridefulness due to the fact that everybody wants to move to LA, and you realize, yeah, it is cool here. I actually don't want to live anywhere else. I could see why you moved here. But, you know, I wasn't necessarily dedicated to any one thing other than, you know, growing up like a punk rock kid and safety pins being so cliche, you know, it's what you hold your clothing up or whatever. And, you know, being from LA, and it was like my little homage to both of those things. And, yeah, I forgot what else I was going to say.
So the Matt Skiba art show was the last public event you had where you invited the public. And I know that attendance was a lot lighter than you had anticipated based on your RSVPs because it was the 13th of March, Friday the 13th. And really the virus really hit the news the following day or that day. What were you looking at going into it? And did you have your eye on the news at that point?
I was paying attention to it, but I wasn't really quite sure what was going to happen. I still sort of thought everything was like maybe getting blown out of proportion. I really couldn't judge. I mean, I watched a couple of the BBC news reels from what was going on in Europe and in China and stuff like that. I was like, wow, it's crazy. But I never could have imagined that it would have been a full-blown shutdown. I mean, it's so sci-fi, like post-apocalyptic. I mean, it's just, I would have never guessed it. So when it really started happening, it started happening very fast. So from the beginning of that day where I was just like, oh, whatever, people are tripping, to the opening of the doors to that show, I was like, you know, a total 180. I was like regretting that we were actually moving forward with the show. So yeah, I mean, it kind of sucked, but I really didn't have any plans from that point on. I didn't know it was going to happen like that. You're going to have to start preparing. And I think there was just this air that whole day, and maybe it was the day before that they announced it, but it was just very like, should we really do this? And, you know, I oftentimes don't totally listen to what, you know, the news says, especially when it starts with stuff like this. So I was like, kind of like, I don't know. This is like, they're probably just tripping. Who knows what's going to happen? So I didn't really feel like the need that we were going to have to shut down. But as the day kept, like, you know, the hours kept ticking by, I was like, you know, I think this is real. I think this is a bad idea. Should we cancel? And I'm asking, like, Matt Skiba's manager, Matt Skiba, and like, I don't know. How do you feel? I'm like, I don't know if I can have an opinion yet, but I feel like it's sort of starting to sink in. And yeah, you know, by the time the doors opened, I was kind of regretting that we were moving forward with it. And I definitely noticed that what we anticipated from just RSVP, we weren't going to get it. And I'm like, and I kind of felt like I'd rather it that way. In all honesty, we maybe had 50 people that passed through the night, maybe a little bit more. And we were anticipating like close to 1,000. And I'm like, I'm actually glad 1,000 people didn't pass through. I don't want to be around people right now. And I don't know if I want to call it paranoia, but my cautiousness kicked in the very next day. I was like, oh no. This is real. This is scary. since then, you know, I kind of have enjoyed the sort of calmness that the world is sort of, well, I don't know how to even put that. There's a calmness in the air when you're driving through LA, and that's been enjoyable. the sort of, you know, the constant fear of somebody might give you some disease and then you might kill your best friend. It really sucks. But I just try and play it safe as best as I can. I have had to adapt with the business. Luckily, my business has never been just one thing. And I usually find that the most challenging thing about my business. But in this case, it was my life raft. Because we are so event-based, and that's really where most of my money comes from throughout the year. And those two things got plucked away. No art shows, no nightlife stuff. I was forced to rely on the clothing side of things. And so we already had an e-commerce presence, and it made it very easy for us to just be like, well, we do have all this clothes that we have and that we can make. And I just really sort of shifted gears to that now, and we've been doing all right. I mean, I think people are really eager to help small businesses, and, you know, people have gotten their stimulus checks and they're trying to stimulate the economy, I guess. I've been doing okay, though. I can't, you know, I'm very much so counting my blessings and feeling grateful that there has been some kind of a weird fallback plan always in place. Nothing's ever been intentional here, but that has been there.
Now, the phrase curbside pickup, if I never hear that again, I'll be okay with it.
Yeah.
I hate that fucking word, that term.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We're such a weird store. I am not even eager to have people here when there isn't a virus. So this ends up being more like my office than anything, because we are so off the beaten path that I don't rely on foot traffic, or, you know, the appointments that we do schedule are so few and far between. We are a very event-based company. So when we have an opening, people are like, oh, cool, I've been wanting to get this shirt or whatever. But, you know, I'm not super keen on having people come by, and certainly not now. I'm like,
so you don't have calls for, you need the Divine pin, the John Wayne Gacy t-shirt, like, and I'll pick it up curbside.
I order it online. They're going to, are really close to killing the post office, help the post office out. No, I think it's easier for me to do online stuff anyway, but you know, our business is small. I do so much of everything, and the help that I do get is from friends. So it ends up being a lot for me to be able to organize that kind of, you know, if people are like ordering stuff online, I have to have it ready in an hour. Like, never be able to do that. I would now know, and I can barely mail it out, let alone, like, you know.
Not a traditional retail space, not a traditional art gallery, but someone who definitely relies on whatever income is brought in, because this is your business. This is how you sustain yourself.
Yeah.
Your events that you do, they've all stopped. So when you were realizing it on the 14th, then what were you thinking about? What did you have planned right after this show?
Oh my God, I don't have any plans. Normally, no. We did have things planned. You know, we were working on doing something with the estate of polystyrene. We're doing a whole exhibit on X-ray specs and poly. But that took a grinding halt right then and there. You know, we had stuff planned throughout the months. You know, we had John Waters' event at the Madonna Inn. We had Danzig at Hollywood Roosevelt. There were quite a few exciting things that were like on the calendar. Like, you know, money is tied up with these events, currently speaking. So it kind of became a little bit of a panicky situation, because I am very event. I rely on a lot of events. And, you know, sort of the clothing side of things or the retail side of things has always been, it almost took a back seat, like right from the beginning where the gallery started like taking over, and I saw a lot of potential in focusing more on the gallery side. So I've never relied on online sales or retail sales. It's just sort of like, I want it there because that was my original vision and I don't want to let it go, but it really hasn't been the bread and butter. So I just sort of waited around to see how things were going to change. Luckily, we had done some really good moves at the beginning of the year, and I wasn't in a bad place financially. So I'm like, okay, it's very nice to walk into this and not be completely like, you know, shit is really bad. But, you know, I knew that was going to change rapidly. So I just kind of waited a little bit.
Have you felt any frustration with the state of the state? Whereas what I mean is we hear, and I would assume you're following the news now a little bit more regarding this because you are a business person.
I mean, I felt like I was watching the news a lot more at the beginning, but I feel like, and call me, I don't know, whatever. Maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. I don't know, but I feel like they like to just put us in a state of like anxiety. And when I start feeling that, I'm like, do I really need to know that, like, you know, 3,000 more people supposedly died today? And I, you know, I'm not saying that it's not true, but I'm also just like, I don't know. I'm not one to really trust like mainstream media. I do listen to it, but I'll also listen to all the alternative media. And even if you want to call it conspiracy theories, and I just try and like have a very sensible point of view. Like I make sure that I'm washing my hands all the time. I'm not getting in contact with people. I'm not visiting friends. I'm not going out. You know, I'm abiding by what feels very logical to me. Like, I don't know what's out there, but I sure as fuck don't want to be a statistic. So I wear my mask. I carry my sanitizer, all that fun stuff. I just play it safe, you know. But do I feel like I'm being like informed correctly? No, I think that none of what we're told is 100% accurate.
So what would your 15-year-old self say to yourself now about trusting the government and what you're being told about the pandemic?
A 15-year-old me was probably too focused on music and probably just repeating what what other musicians said about things that didn't pertain to me. You know, I think 15-year-old me was as cynical as 37-year-old me is. But I don't know. As I've, you know, experienced life, I feel like, you know, you do end up noticing that what we're told is oftentimes not the truth, you know, whether it's been sensationalized or, you know, they tell us a very bold-faced lie to, you know, quote-unquote protect us. And after a while, you're just like, I don't know, man. I don't know. We have a fucked up system. You know, everything's corrupt. You know, I'm not that I'm apathetic or anything like that, but I just try and do what feels right and correct. And, you know, I'm not trying to add to the chaos. You know, I think probably the most important things that we have is our freedom of speech. So those are the types of things that I like to focus on, if you will. That might be political in some way.
What were some of your favorite events that you've had at the gallery, and as well as some of your favorite shows or parties that you've thrown? Whether it's a live show, because you do work with bands, and then you will also have Sex Cells, mm-hmm. which is something completely different.
Yeah. My favorite art show, I would have to say it's Lee Black Childers. It's a photographer from the 70s. He was Andy Warhol's assistant and managed Iggy and the Stooges and David Bowie during the Ziggy Stardust tour. I mean, he's got an amazing resume. But he was just shooting photos, you know, similar like Bob Gruen or Mick Rock. But his photos were, in a bizarre way, more intimate. Like, you could tell that when you saw a photo of Lou Reed that he took, you could tell that Lou Reed actually liked the guy that was holding that camera. Like, there's just a completely different, you see this attitude in Lou Reed photos where he's posturing. And here he's just like smiling. Like, you could tell he's enjoying the interaction. And, you know, I was always fascinated by him. I only knew his name through being the manager of the Heartbreakers, Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, and kind of just a name that was always there. And I, you know, got in touch with him through a friend, and I got to know him a little bit. And he was a quirky little old gay man from the South that had a million and one stories about a million and one things. And I just liked his attitude and his view on life. And, you know, I asked him if I could show his photos, and he was kind of like, oh, darling, I'm old. I don't really care about that. Like, everybody always bothers me about it. It's so much work, and I don't end up, like, making very much money off of it. I'm like, I'll pay for all of it. He's like, no, I don't know. I mean, what do you want to show? I'm like, whatever you want to show. I like all the raunchy stuff that you took photos of, like people that weren't famous. And he's like, ah, okay, now we're talking. You know, I guess he gets asked about like Rolling Stones and John Lennon photos and stuff like that. And he's just like, oh, I don't care about them, darling. They were boring. He had rather, you know, he shot a lot of street hustlers and junkies and things like that. So anyway, we came to some terms where he's just like, I'll do it as long as I get to completely have control of what I show and I get to call the show whatever I want to call it. And I'm like, yeah, for sure. And he called it, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but something along the lines of rock stars, pickpockets, junkies, rent boys, I don't know, something in punks. Drag queens and punks, something like that. A really long string of words. And I mean, kind of cutting it short. We did the show. I came to understand that he was ill from his assistant. I didn't quite know what that meant. When they arrived in LA, I was warned that he was quite ill and probably shouldn't be out. And I'm like, okay, well, let's just take him to the hotel. I'm like, no. He wants to do this. I'm just telling you, he's a little bit, he looks ill. I'm like, what do you mean he looks ill? He's been drinking and he probably shouldn't be. I'm like, okay. And I know he battles alcoholism. Like, well, they told him if he drinks, he would probably die and he shouldn't be drinking. All right. So when he gets here, he was full-blown jaundice. I mean, like Simpsons character yellow, like startlingly yellow, like really, like it gave you almost like a, I wanted to greet him, but almost like it shocked you to the point like, oh my God, like I almost hesitate to shake your hand. It's crazy to see somebody like that. And, you know, I was like, are you okay? Do you really want to do this? And he's like, no, I definitely want to do this. He's all, if I learned anything from these people was the show must go on. I'm like, all right, whatever. You know, we had like Joe D'Alessandro here and Hollywood Lawn, and there's so many like characters from that era and members of Blondie. And I mean, people that looked up to him, like he was the older guy that was taking pictures and putting them in Roxy and Cream. Like they worshiped him. He came from a slightly older generation than all these like first generation punk rockers. So there was a lot of those who's who in the crowd. And, you know, it was great. He told stories. You know, Hollywood Lawn did a little impromptu sing-along to Take a Walk on the Wild Side. It was really, really amazing, really magical night. You know, we got him to Hollywood's place. I went to go visit him the next day. He looked incredibly ill. He was holding on to, like, a whole gallon of gin that he had almost finished. And I'm looking at them both, and she's got her wig off, and she's rolling around her apartment. And I'm like, are you guys okay? And I'm feeling kind of guilty about the situation. Like, did I, like, cause him to go on a really wild bender? And, you know, I'm asking, are you okay? What's is there anything I could do? How are you feeling? He's like, oh, darling, don't worry about it. You know, when I get back to New York, I'm going to detox. I've done this before. Don't worry. I know what I'm doing. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, oh my God, this guy is like going to die. I don't even know how to feel. And, you know, Hollywood Lawn's just like, oh my God, the opening was fabulous, darling. Oh my God, it's the best opening I've ever been to. And whether that were true or not, which I doubt it was very cool to hear these icons, you know, give me any kind of praise for the event. And, you know, it was very wholehearted what he felt. He's just like, you know, I thought this was going to be a small get together. And somehow there was a line wrapped around the block with people I hadn't seen in like 20 years. And, you know, I think he got some sort of weird cathartic thing from it. And I obviously can't speak for him, but I think he just didn't want to go back to New York. And he had explained, you know, he's like, nobody knows who I am in New York anymore. I live on Avenue Z. Nobody visits me. I'm dying in like a little apartment with a whole bunch of people that don't care if I live or die. And, you know, I kind of got the sentiment that there was some sort of darkness brewing in his head. And anyway, you know, he said he was fine and he wanted me to like leave so he can rest. A couple hours later, I heard that he was rushed to Cedars-Sinai because he was going into like an alcoholic shock or something like that. He died maybe a week later. And then that's when everything got really interesting for me because, you know, he got it in the New York Post and New York Times and we had the last of his work. And it was kind of like the vultures came out. And a lot of weird things happened. I had to deal with the family and this was all so foreign to me and I had no idea like what protocol is for something like this. And the family, you know, I talked to them. They were kind of aggressive and weirded out. And they were sort of like, you know, they hadn't been in contact with him. And he had issues with his family over like his lifestyle and whatnot. And they were very like Southern Christian people. But his brother did give me some sort of interesting comment. You know, I explained, you know, how everything went down, you know, after the show. And he's just like, I know, you know, probably don't know my brother very well. He's like, you shouldn't feel guilty about the situation or anything like that. He's like, one of his favorite celebrities, and I can't remember the name, but was a movie star that committed suicide by calling all the media to come to her home. And she was going to take a whole bunch of pills and lay down on her bed covered in roses. But she got sick from all the pills she took. So she had to run to the bathroom where she was vomiting, slipped on her vomit, cracked her head, and died on the toilet covered in vomit. And he thought that that was like his favorite way of going out because the media came and they found her dead but covered in vomit and blood in the bathroom when she was supposed to leave this beautiful, glamorous corpse. And didn't work out that way. So that was his idol. He's all, so I'm telling you, chances are he did what he did consciously and he wanted to go. And you gave him the best farewell party that he could have asked for. So I can say thank you for giving him that. I don't know what went on in his mind, but I'm willing to bet he had a very sick sense of humor. All right, whatever. That's cool, I guess. So that honestly was the one that impacted me the most. I got so much out of like things from him, just his attitude on life. And I don't know, just his point of view. He was so, I don't know, just like one of those wise wizards that like everything that they say is so meaningful and you like take it in and you're like, can't even imagine like, I don't know, just the life experience around being around so many interesting characters. And you could tell he was very empathic in the sense that he was like, I went after all these, really these dysfunctional people because I am one of those dysfunctional people. Like I get it. He's like, has a story about Sid Vicious. And he's like, when I met him, I knew he was going to die. Like I knew this guy was going to die way before his time. And, you know, I even cried the first time I met him because I was like, wow, I feel something about this guy. And he's not going to get to live to his fullest like potential. But anyway, he was just a really interesting character. And that was my very favorite show that we did as far as art gallery shows. Probably the most interesting show I did, nightlife promoting related, would be when we did something with Michael Alleg that caused a lot of drama. And it was a huge test on me in general, just as a person and as a professional, and really what kind of like what I stand for and how my business is going to operate from that point on. I felt like I was backed up against a wall and really had to take a really bird's eye view of the situation and what anything that I say will be used against me later. So I was like, how do I navigate through this while being very genuine? And I felt like I was being bullied, to be quite honest with you. I don't know if you know people know too much about Michael Alleg, but he was the original party monster. It's what the movies are based on. His story has been dramatized and sensationalized and cherry-picked to make a much more interesting, a more interesting storyline. But he's very, very vilified, and rightfully so. He did some pretty heinous things. But at the same time, you got to take it in for what it is. It was a 24-year-old kid who basically got the keys to the city of Manhattan. You know, he was the king of Manhattan at 24 years old. He ran 4 clubs simultaneously a week and was killing it, making like 20 grand a night. And he says it, he's like, you know, drugs got involved, money got involved. My head grew, my ego grew. The people that were around me were like, you know, now more leechy. And there was like the fun was starting to fizzle out and the dark stuff started like coming in. And he says, you know, once drugs got involved, things got weird. You know, my roommate was a drug dealer. He attacked me. My other roommate then defended me. That drug dealer died due to the incident and we freaked out because we just killed a drug dealer and we were being investigated by the DA. And, you know, what do junkies do when a situation like this happens? You go find drugs. He's like, we went through his room because we wanted to make sure that when we called the cops that there were no drugs in the house, obviously, as junkies, we did all the drugs, probably trying to maybe numb ourselves or maybe even kill ourselves just to make the whole thing go away because we had a dead person in the living room. And, you know, when we kind of came out of, you know, we woke up after doing so much heroin that, you know, could have killed a horse, we realized that a whole day had passed. And we're like, okay, we got a cold body with dry blood in the living room now. And we just went through his entire room. And now it doesn't look like an accident. And so they start freaking out more. And another day passes, same story. And then before he knew it, he was just like, it was too late. We couldn't call the cops. We should have. He's all, if we would have called the cops, we would have gotten maybe 2 years for possession of drugs and manslaughter. Instead, we decided to dispose of his body. He's all, yeah. He's all, I learned not to do that. You know, he's like, just call the cops. So anyway, you know, I'm not like saying, you know, I don't know what to say. I can't imagine myself in a situation like that. So I try not to judge. I don't know. I've gone down some dark times too, and I hate to say it, but shit like that could happen. And you don't know what you're going to do in a situation like that or in a state of mind like that. And at an age where you're just so stupid and you don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow or if there tomorrow even matters. So I try not to be too opinionated about it. And, you know, I was always fascinated by what he did, not crime-wise, just what he did in nightlife in general. And that's a very fascinating story, even if you remove the whole, you know, heinous crime. But I always was interested in him. And, you know, I would even write to him because I thought he was like very Malcolm McLaren type character. And I don't know, you know, I was trying to do an art show with him because he did a whole bunch of art in jail, which I thought was really interesting. He basically, according to him, was getting beat up and raped and whatever else was going on in jail. And they told him, the best thing we could do is put you in solitary confinement for your safety. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But supposedly while he was in solitary confinement, he took up painting. And he started painting what he remembered and enjoyed of his like previous life. So vials of K and lines of cocaine and Amanda Lepore and Lee Bowery and all these characters and, you know, elements of nightlife culture that he was surrounded with. And it becomes this very unusual, almost like pop art, very Warhol-esque type thing. And oddly enough, it also kind of reminds me of John Wayne Gacy's paintings. So there's this really simple, childish, with a hint of dark, like art to it. And I wanted to show it. I went to his place when he got out. I saw all the art that he had made in jail. He made all like 300 things in there. And like he got to take it with him or he was mailing it to friends. I don't really know the story there. But I liked it. And I'm like, I want to show. And he's like, I just don't want to show the stuff that I did in jail. I'm like, it's pretty interesting, to be honest with you. I'm like, if you really like contextualize what it's about, like that was your therapy. And like you were looking at your mistakes through you painting. And I'm like, I don't know. I think it's pretty deep, to be honest. He's like, yeah, but that will always be associated to me being the killer. I'm like, I mean, you got to own it and embrace it before you move past it, right? He's all, I don't want to do that. I don't know. It was very difficult. Anyway, he wanted to do a whole new series. And we went back and forth. Really couldn't come to any conclusion. I started noticing he was a little bit weirder than I thought he was. And I'm like, do I really want to go down this path? And maybe it's a masochistic thing of mine. But I was like, you know, whatever. This will be interesting. And it's part, you know, I'd like to do it. I think it's meaningful to me. I think I'd like to shine some light on the topic. Whatever, you know, I don't know where this is going to go. And, you know, we booked. I felt like if I pressured him by like, let's put a date on the calendar. Let's get you flights out here. He would work faster because he really wanted to do a whole new series, which is also a very interesting series. But I think he's talked about it. But he wanted to paint celebrities with STD viruses and make a comparison to how celebrities are just like STDs. Like once you catch the bug, you're, you know, whatever, infected. Anyway, I was like, cool, that's fine. Let's do it. Never did it. And we had a date on the calendar. And I'm like, I mean, I don't know what to do. Like, we could just show your art that you have. And he's like, I don't want to do that. I'm like, I mean, then we do this night called Sex Cells. I mean, it's some kind of homage to like those days of New York that you were a part of. I guess it wouldn't be really off brand if like you participated in it. We can kind of like do a litmus test, if you will, to see like how LA would react to you being in the public eye. I don't know. I'm like, what do you think? He's like, yeah, why not? He's like, well, if you're going to go in that direction, why don't you try and get like Kaoki? I'm like, and that was his partner at the time and the DJ of the like in nightlife back then. And, you know, he's in the documentaries and all of that. Also, he's a big character in that storyline. And so I'm like, fuck it. All right. As Kaoki was into it, obviously we were sort of starting to play around with the and spinning it into a very Party Monster-esque thing, which was a little bit, I don't know if I want to toy around with that too much, but people would be fascinated by it because it's such a, I mean, it's an influential era, no matter, I mean, you could say whatever you want to say, but I mean, you know, RuPaul came out of there. So many characters came out of there, you know, it is what it is. So I was like, all right, let's try it. We announced it. We had Miss Kitten DJing. We had Kaoki DJing. And we had Michael Alec hosting, which is really a glorified term for attending. And so I was like, it's pretty innocent. I don't really see what the harm in that is. And, you know, a lot of people were just like, whoa, this is fucking crazy. Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm totally there. I was, like, obsessed with that movie. I was obsessed with that documentary. Oh, my God. I can't believe he got out. This is crazy. So on and so forth. Mind you, he served 17 years in jail. So I feel like he did pay his debt to society. Whatever he does with his time as a free man, can't say he's made the best choices. But, you know, I don't know. That's a whole nother conversation. But we went fine with it for a minute. And then I don't know where somebody made a comment and then another negative comment and another negative comment. Before I knew it, there was a whole like conversation going on about how this was like really wrong. And they spun it into a queer topic. And I assume they didn't know that I was gay. And they're like, this is dangerous to the queer community. And I'm like, what? And then they were spinning into people of color topic. And I'm like, I'm a person of color and I'm gay. Like, what's your angle here? I don't know. And I kind of just let them talk. And I think I infuriated them more by not commenting. And then a petition like sprung up and I was like, what's the petition for? And they're like, I guess they want you to not have Michael Alec. I'm like, how do petitions work? I'm like, I don't understand. Like, well, I guess once they get to a certain amount of number, they could take it to whoever they feel like taking it, whether it's the media or the owners of the venue, or I don't know. I think what you should be most in fear of is them taking it to the media. And I'm like, what's that going to do? I mean, I don't really understand like, I don't know. It's kind of a bizarre way of telling me be like us or you're going to be our enemy. I don't know. It was bizarre. It was a really bizarre situation for me. I kind of just let it go and roll off, like, you know, I don't know. I'm going to do it. I'm like, I don't really want to be told what I can and cannot do. And I know why I'm doing it. I'm not glorifying him as murderer. I'm obviously, you know, we have this night that's very New York-esque, very Club Kid-esque. And, you know, he was a character in that era. Anyway, the long-winded version of it is that we got a lot of hatred for it. And I had to make some sort of statement about it. And my statement was, generally speaking, you know, you don't have to like what I do, but you can't tell me what to do. Like, you know, we are an art gallery that promotes nightlife events. And as an art gallery, I'm arming myself with the fact that I'm entitled to have an opinion. I'm entitled to raise a question. I'm entitled to create dialogue. You do not have to engage, but you don't have to shut me down. I am gay. I am brown. And you're making this into a topic that is irrelevant. You are making it sound like the scene that I created, I can't manage. You don't have to attend. Bottom line, you know, I don't know what to say, but you know, if you shut me up, it's more dangerous than me doing this, which is totally legal. I just felt like it was this very interesting conversation about, you know, like, I mean, it ended up being kind of like gay politics, but it was just kind of like, so you want me to be gay, but gay like you, which I don't know what that means. You don't want me to like certain things because therefore I'm an enemy to the quote unquote gay community. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I think that controversy is something that
since then or around that time has been your friend. I would say that you're not...
I'm not bashful about liking the things that I like, and I don't feel like I have to apologize for it. You know, I think having a healthy understanding of why you're fascinated by something is okay. You know, I mean, our news is based on crime and, you know, people dying. It's something that we're always having to deal with. And sometimes, you know, those, I mean, look, there's channels dedicated to it. There's conventions dedicated to it, you know, and it's not really that foreign to be fascinated by it. And I don't see what the harm in it is. I think it's much more harmful to tell somebody you can't think like that, and that's not okay, and you need to apologize for thinking how differently than I think.
I mean, you certainly do present sort of the darker side of pop culture, if to me that's what I would call it, or underground culture maybe. Because
yeah, I mean, I think. Pop culture in general is dark. It's all fucking weird, you know? It's like, oh, look, listen, there's this anorexic girl that's like completely fucking wasted out of her mind, but she's so cute. Oh, and she showed her vagina by accident. She's my new hero. You know, it's all really bleak and weird. It just depends how you want to look at it. You know, to me, I find it all fascinating, you know? And Jonas Brothers are just as fascinating as Charles Manson to me.
And I do appreciate it completely. I get it. I know what you're doing. I can see what you're doing. At least I think I can see what you're doing. When Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was mm-hmm. released or was being talked about or filmed, what gave you the idea? Like when you heard about it, was this when you first thought about doing a Charles Manson exhibit, or was it after the movie came out, or when did you plan on doing that? I saw people were pissed that you were doing it.
Were they? I didn't even pay attention. I learned not to pay attention to that stuff because it's just going to sidetrack me and make me lose sleep and worry that someone's going to shoot me and, you know, whatever. If that happens, that happens. But, you know, from the Michael Alec thing, I knew right then and there that if I apologized, which I think is – it's not that it's bad to apologize if you've done something wrong, but I didn't feel like I did anything wrong. Like the most I could apologize was for, I'm sorry you don't agree with me. I'm sorry we don't agree. I'm sorry. I don't know what to say. That's the world. But I knew if the moment I said, if I redacted and backpedaled and said, I'm sorry, and this was a mistake, and I shouldn't have done this, when I wholeheartedly don't feel that way, I would not only have to apologize for everything I've done, but I'll have to apologize for everything I want to do. And so I was like, I can't. I want to be that gallery that touches subjects that others don't want to touch. Or I just want to, you know, peek in behind the curtain on things that are taboo. Like, why not? I mean, how as a society do we progress if we shut ourselves out to stuff? That's not how it works. You know, I mean, the Klan would still be running around if that was the case. You know, people would still be getting, you know, the rocks thrown at them for being gay or black. You know, you have to push a boundary to change an opinion. You know, Abraham Lincoln wanted to free the slaves. That was super problematic at one time. It's all a matter of opinion at the end of the day. And as time changes, people change. And I just kind of thought, you know, I don't really think I should apologize for essentially having an opinion. And so anyway, when the Charles Manson thing came to be, you know, I've always been fascinated by 60s culture. And I really do think like that summer is when counterculture and everything sort of sprouted. Like from Charles Manson to the Beach Boys and Mamas and the Papas, the whole hippie era is the beginning of something new. It's when kids started saying, I don't believe what my parents believe, and I don't believe what the government is saying. And that's the sort of like the first ripple. And so, I don't know, to me, Charles Manson, not that I glorify him as like an anti-hero, but he was certainly, he was the poster child for what the hippie era represented, which was counterculture. We are against the system. And they used him as, if your kid listens to the Beatles, if your kid has a beard, and if your kid has a bandana wrapped around his head and, you know, dances with flowers in her hair, she's probably a hippie and hippies kill. And to me, that ended up being sort of where a lot of these other subcultures started sprouting from, you know, whether it be, you know, experimental noise or, you know, I think it's sort of like the beginning of like, I just think it's the beginning of everything, in my opinion. I just always enjoyed looking at it from a cultural sense of how that changed society and youth culture, really. But anyway, everybody heard that they were filming that movie, with that Tarantino movie. Somebody brought to my attention that we worked with in the past, and they were like, hey, I have a friend that has this really large collection of Manson stuff. It's all pop culture stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. They're like, we'd like to do an exhibit based on that. And I'm like, I don't really know if I feel comfortable doing that. I'm like, I think if you're going to do it, you got to do it all the way. Like, you know, I think showing like old newspaper. I'm like, let me put you this way. I'm the one that's going to have a target on my back as soon as I say I'm doing a Charles Manson exhibit. I'm like, if I'm going to have a target on my back, I might as well make it worth it. I'm like, I don't want to just show newspaper clippings. If I can, I want to show it all. Like whatever I can get my hands on. And there certainly are people that are affiliated or like really close contacts to that whole circle. So yeah, that guy kind of didn't like the idea because I sort of like took the concept and you know, kind of expanded on it. And you know, it wasn't exclusively his collection. But I was like, take it or leave it. We're either doing it my way or we're not doing it because I don't know any other gallery that's going to touch on it. I'm like, maybe Museum of Death, but I doubt they care because they have a much more interesting collection than just Charles Manson himself. But we did that. I got in contact with a couple of people that I felt could put me in you know, the direction that I needed to be in. Michael Channels being one of the biggest ones. He, you know, wrote to Charles Manson. He's fighting for the estate with, you know, supposedly like a relative of Charles Manson. So he was the most interesting and intimate character related to Charles Manson himself. You know, Charles Manson left him a will and now he's fighting to legitimize that will. So anyway, I had to penetrate that really tight circle of Charles Manson affiliates. And he was kind of my first one because he seemed like the most sane and kind of cool. He was kooky, but he had a really more down-to-earth opinion of it. I think a lot of the other people were really just like, I'm not a Manson follower. Everyone else, all these other people are. But then I'd hear what they'd say, and I'm like, kind of a Manson follower. And Michael's way more chill, and he understands what a kooky world that he's involved in, and he just has a much more down-to-earth opinion about all of it. And, you know, he invited me to his house. He kind of felt me out. He checked me out. He kind of got a feel for who I was, what I was, and he dug my vibe, and then he kind of was like, all right, you want to see the real collection? I'm like, oh, this isn't it? He was like, oh, no. Inside, and it was like 25 years of like archiving personal things of like Charles Manson to, you know, I mean, he went down the rabbit hole. He explains it this way. He was an autograph junkie. He was one of those guys that goes to autograph shows. You know, you walk into his apartment and the first thing you see is a fully autographed League of Their Own poster, which cracked me up because I'm like, is that Madonna's autograph? He's like, oh yeah. I'm like, oh, rad, that's cool. And so he explains that, you know, he was just an autograph weirdo. And he had a thought of like, well, I've always liked horror movies. I've always been obsessed with that kind of stuff. And, you know, who's the ultimate boogeyman in real life other than Charles Manson? Well, he's still alive. I'll try and get Charles Manson to autograph an 8x10. You know, it took him like 5 years before Charles Manson wrote back and signed an autograph. By then, he had already gone down the whole wormhole and, you know, contacted Tex Watson and Susan Atkins and you name it, anybody he could to try and like gain some insight on how to get in touch with Charles Manson. He really knew very little about that whole world, but he, you know, quickly got a good understanding. So by the time he got Charles Manson's autograph, he had already collected a couple others and he's just like, wow, I feel like so invested in this. I might as well get everybody's. So, and he knew so much about it at that point that he's like, and I've heard they've been humanized to him that he's just like, you know, the Tex Watson that I know isn't quite like the Tex Watson that I've read about. The Susan Atkins that I know isn't quite the Sadie that they talk about. And so, you know, at that point, he wanted to uncover all of the, you know, all of the puzzle pieces. And before he knew it, he had a friendship with Charles Manson and all these people. And he was visiting them and writing to them and, you know, they would send him art and so on and so forth. And, you know, he kind of made it a personal mission to really understand what they were talking about. And oftentimes they had to talk in code. And he basically got a much more bigger understanding of what was portrayed in the media and what these people went through and what seems like is what really happened. But nobody knows because nobody wants to really talk about it. So it became a big, like, unsolved mystery thing to him. And anyway, he lent me his collection. From there, you know, I wanted to talk to other people that I knew were sort of experts in that field. We talked to, you know, Nicholas Schreck from Radio Werewolf. It was always like, you know, it was involved in the Church of Satan at one point and really always invested in knowing the facts about the Manson murders. And contacted him. He was difficult to sort of, you know, all these people, like, it'll take a certain amount of effort to gain their trust. And once we kind of had his trust, he had a whole different perspective on things and had all these interesting facts and all these other people that he knows. And anyway, they helped me collect this big group of people that would be considered, like, real, how can you put it? They're, like, very, very detectives of, like, what would be considered the non-popular version of, you know, the Manson murders, which is, you know, they all kind of have a different version of it. But essentially, the media vilified them much, made a much more sensationalized story out of it than it really was. And so to me, it was even more fascinating to kind of hear, like, oh, what are these alternate theories? And how are you debunking this one theory that has been so known for 40 years, 50 years? So anyway, that's kind of what I did. And, you know, it was very powerful for me because I knew that it was like, I'm sure I'm going to ruffle some feathers and it's a really delicate time to be doing it. But, you know, I feel like Quentin Tarantino opened up that door and it was going to really gain a lot of popularity, the topic itself. And I think people might want to just, I didn't say what it was. I didn't say what my opinion on it is. I didn't want to dictate any of that. I just said, here's a lot of interesting artifacts that depict a totally different story than what you might have heard. You make your own opinion. And that's pretty much what we did with it. And, you know, I don't think I got that much hate mail over it. Maybe I did. I don't know.
Or maybe it was the John Wayne Gacy show.
John Wayne Gacy show probably got a lot of hate also. And, you know, also that to me is fascinating in a totally different way. I mean, he upset the art world more than anything. I think, you know, he took the template of Andy Warhol. It always goes back to Andy Warhol too, I think. But he took the template of Andy Warhol, make a really cheap piece of art that has a repetition. And sell them at a crazy price. And see how many you can sell, basically. So John Waters took that idea, made his rudimentary prints out of like pencil stencils. And he knew that there were weirdos that liked serial killers. And if he had a little advertisement in magazines, somebody would be interested in buying a $40 painting. And eventually he got representation. And he had a book publishing deal. And he had an art dealer. And he had a very high-profile art show in Beverly Hills that was put together by no other than Tony Curtis. The people that bought the artwork there were a young Christian Bale, Johnny Depp, Jack Nicholson, and who knows who else in the A-lister, you know, Hollywood world, which immediately brought the value of his art up. And the way that the sort of regular art world judges art is by who are the collectors, what celebrities have bought it, and what well-known collectors have bought it. And that's what ups your value. So immediately, John Wayne Gacy's $40 stencils became $20,000, very, like, collectible art. And that was very upsetting to people, you know, for obvious reasons. But he had not broken any law yet, and he exploited that. And he had a 1-900 number and he had a fan club. And I mean, he pretty much ran a racket, an art racket. He had cellmates painting for him. He had a business and it was his means of survival. You know, he was a fat white dude that molested and killed kids. He had a target on his head in jail. He knew it. He knew he was going to get killed before his execution. So the best thing he could do was buy his safety. And the only thing he knew what he could gain some sort of like power was if he had money. And that's how he figured it out. So the whole thing is very fascinating if you take the time to look at it and look at it from like a societal kind of point of view of like, you know, we are the ones that glorify these people. We are the ones that put these like characters on the cover of Time magazine and, you know, give them the front page news and all of that. And eventually those people notice, they're like, we're celebrities. We're just as big as these A-listers. And in that sense, I think pop culture is dark, weird, and fun and exciting to take a look at from every angle. But, you know, I ain't the first. I ain't the last, you know.
When you had the screening at the Zebulon, a very plausible alternate series of events or alternate timeline was presented. So I feel that you did succeed in that.
Yeah, I mean, I learned as much as I hoped anybody else had learned. You know, some of these people spent like 30 years like very dedicated to wanting to find out what they feels more like the truth. And I'm always down with conspiracy theories. I mean, sometimes they make a hell of a lot more sense with what the popular narrative is. And with good reason, too. You're just like, of course, 1960s police was corrupt. We know that for a fucking fact. 1990s police was corrupt. You know, why would we think that the 60s wasn't? Celebrities were involved in drugs? No, shocking, impossible. You know, so like, yeah, his version was honestly makes a lot more sense. And when we first talked to him, he was like, you know, you're going to do something really, you know, it's very provocative and you might find yourself with a lot of, you know, a lot of negativity that you might not be prepared for. And I'm like, I kind of have been down that path before. He's like, all right. Well, he's like, you know, I ended up just asking him like, in a short version, what do you think really happened? And he's just like, honestly, it's not very fascinating. And he's like, and that's what's the weird thing about it. He's like, if you boil it down to the core, it's a bad drug deal. He's like, it's not really that fascinating to write about it. He's like, but if you throw in all the other crazy stuff that, you know, the book Helter Skelter has, yeah, it's going to change society. So, but if you say a bunch of hippies sold some drug to some, like, you know, rich people burned them, and they got involved in, like, drug warfare, it's not, I mean, it's exciting, so, but it's not as exciting as a race war.
and that's, I think, why... When I think of lethal amounts, I think of sort of the darker side of everything because it's not, it's an art show, but there's a lot more to it because it's either who's doing the art or the subject matter. And I think that's what your fan base, if you will, because you do say you treat it as a band, lethal amounts. I think that's what they might expect from you.
I mean, there's tons of bands that sing about these topics, you know, for the same reason I'm doing art shows. It's fascinating. It's I don't want to say it's inspiring, but it makes you want to think, you know, it's thought provoking. You know, why did these young teenage girls follow this hippie? Is it really because of what they say, or is it just something much more easy? They were chicks that wanted drugs and were on drugs, you know?
And as far as conspiracy theories would go, now, I do listen to a lot of news radio. I watch a lot of television, and I do read. I tend to avoid anything that's online, like Facebook, what have you.
Yeah.
It's just usually it's all bullshit anyway. But going back to, say, like Coast to Coast, the Art Bell or George Norrie, you know, they do talk about this. They touch on the coronavirus and... You know, it leads you to ask a lot more questions that, oh, this is how it is. This is how it's going to be. And have you encountered that sort of thinking as well?
For myself?
Yes.
Like, do I...
Well, about the... Do you feel there's a conspiracy theory element...
Or that corona?
...to it?
Yeah. But I think everything... There's some darker... I mean, I think everything is involved in, like, has to do with profit. I mean, I think that's what our capitalist society is based on. Our dollar bill says, "In God we trust." I mean, you can't have it more plain and simple than that and in your face. You know, that is our God. That's what our society worships. And that's what really pushes all of these people in power to, you know, go after. I don't really know what the reality of, you know, the COVID thing is. I want to play it safe and, you know, try not to breathe on one another and wash my hands and all that fun stuff. I'm sure that there's a virus out there. I don't entirely know what it's all about. I really don't. I've heard so many conspiracy theories now, and they're fascinating to me, and I'll be like addicted to that one thought for a minute, and I'll be like, yes, that's what this is about. This totally makes sense. And then like 10 minutes later, I'm like, I'm being crazy. No, it's not. But there's probably a very small fraction of that that theory that is probably true, you know. I don't know. I think what we're told is always, mainstream news is always, it's passed through so many filters and it's really about guiding our opinions and keeping us in a sort of like sedated state of mind of like, don't react, like it's futile. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, they don't want us to break out in riots. You know, they don't want us to really go against what they need us to fall in line with. So I don't know. I don't know what it's all about. I just don't really, buy everything they're saying.
I mean, I had thought there would be some kind of uprising in LA. Like I was like, oh my God, people are going to go crazy. Bubble's going to burst and they're going to go ape shit. But it hasn't happened.
I feel like that's a big part of social media. I feel like now people have this bizarre outlet that, you know, I even feel like I've experienced. You know, I would much more respect somebody coming down and picketing my store than doing a bullshit, like, online petition. And I don't know. I don't know. Is that how you deal with it? That's your version of activism? You fucking complain on Facebook?
Because you know everyone who hears you.
Yeah. Is gonna and so I think that we're just in such a, we're boiled it down to like the stupidest way of thinking that I feel like they created that environment for us to feel like our opinions matter. You know, we get addicted to those likes and those, you know, we're like, oh my God, nobody commented on my post. You know, like, does it matter? No, not really. But I feel like people get, you know, they get their rocks off on that and they feel like that's enough. And I would have kind of expected a riot, but no, I think they know how to play us really well now.
Without really getting into the detail, because you probably can't, but up until the virus had become a thing, your biggest challenge was a legal challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can say as many words about it as you want. Is that still ongoing or has it been settled or you are not allowed to talk about it at all?
Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to talk about it at all.
So blink once if it's still going. So I guess, yeah, it's something that hasn't been settled. You know, that sucks because you're more important than to the community that you may even realize. In LA, we have different promoters who promote different things. We have the punk rock and the indie rock promoters, the goth and the dark wave promoters, and then we have the gay and the metal or whatever it is. But you kind of cross the line. You sort of have your hand in a few different areas as far as promoting goes, and I think that is important. You know, there's Das Bunker, but, you know, for the more goth and dance-oriented, dark wave sort of thing. And then Lethal Amounts, it does Sex Cells and Summer Tramp, but then you'll bring in Death in June, or you had Psychic TV, and you've had a lot of different things that I think that fills a void that I think people need. I think it is very important.
I hope so. I mean, I love what I do at the end of the day, and not to sound like it's totally self-righteous, but I do tend to just do things I like, and I'm glad. I mean, I'd be a liar if I said I don't know other people are going to come to it. I wouldn't be doing it, but I do try and go after things that I feel like I want to see it. I really want to see Mark Allman. I really fucking want to see Mark Allman. It's going to cost me an arm and a leg to make that happen, but I get to see Mark Allman. I'm so happy that people bought tickets so it didn't come out of pocket. But at the end of the day, it's totally selfish, you know. And anything, any of these controversial characters, to me, like, I want to get to know them. I want to have tea with the devil. That's pretty much how I feel about it. I'm like, I want to know why this person is so vilified. And I don't know if it's true. And sometimes it has been true. But I want to know for myself. I want to get to know these characters and make my own opinion. And that's just kind of how it is. And I'm multifaceted and I like multifaceted people. And I think, I don't know, just sticking to one thing is so fucking boring. And then it's ignorant, you know, and people are like, oh, I don't listen to that. I don't like that. You're like, you're missing out. You're totally missing out. There's some really good pop out there that, you know, I mean, I don't fucking like Lady Gaga, but, you know, there's other things that are not that far from Lady Gaga that I'll be like, I hate to say it. It's like a good song. I don't want to admit it, but I could totally tap my toes to that. I could back that. That's pretty good.
Because it's funny to me just to see it all. One day you've got the Halloween show at Black Rabbit Rose. Danzig's over there in the corner, who's someone that I think when you don't have access to see him quite a bit, like you do see him a lot in LA out and about, but I think, you know, he has sort of his public perception is he's not like a fun guy, right? Yeah. And then he's at your event having a great time. Then you've got selfies posted with him on Instagram, flying in a plane, going to a Misfit show, and they're having a great time. So, you know, he seems like he might have some fun.
He's a really fun guy. I mean, of course, you know, he's got a, I don't know. I mean, I feel like people like that are such easy targets, and, you know, he has such a, he created this character, right? I think everybody creates a character, especially when they're in the limelight. And after a while, you could be enslaved to that character. And, you know, you have to present yourself in a certain way. You know, I think Glenn is actually pretty genuine about his character, but even so, for him to say something that would be considered out of character, people are like, oh my God, Danzig is carrying cat litter. You're like, yeah, he has cats. Is that really that weird? Why are you fucking with the guy? Like, I'm like, why don't you fuck with assholes like Ted Nugent? You know, I don't know. That to me is kind of weird in a way. But, you know, I think he's funny. He's cool. He's down to earth. And when he can sort of like relax, you know, he's got a really interesting point of view, and his taste is really kind of silly. You know, I heard he liked ABBA once, and I was like, yo, Glenn, I hear you're a big ABBA fan. And you could tell he was kind of like tensed up. He's just like, I'm like, I'm not making fun of you. I love ABBA. And he's like, yeah, I like ABBA. What about it? I'm like, what's your favorite song? He's like, what is this, 20 questions? I'm like, I'm curious. What's your favorite song? Is it like more of their glammy stuff, or what is it? And he's like, I mean, the best song is Dancing Queen. I'm like, what? Really? That's so typical. But, you know, he can leave his guard down. And I think, you know, I think everybody wants to be treated like a human. And if, you know, you can surround yourself with people that see you as that, it's a lot more easy to just like let those quirky things come out. I don't know. I love Glenn. I've known him for a while, so I have a totally different perspective. But, you know, I think a lot of people immediately assume he's going to be a certain way, and they behave a certain way towards him, and he reacts the way that they were expecting.
When the virus really became to be a thing, you'd put the tickets, or not you, but the tickets had gone on sale for the Elvis show that he was doing two, one here and one in San Francisco. So were you in discussion with him, or is his management, or you're friends with him, so him, I guess, about what may or may not happen with that show?
I mean, I think we're all just waiting to see. I think, you know, the whole industry, nightlife, concert industry itself is just, I don't know, we're all just kind of like looking at like what the hell's going to happen. Most people have made the decision that it's just best to plan far into the future and assume that there's a vaccine when those shows come up. But I'm a much more small promoter. Everything comes out of pocket. So I don't know what to say. I mean, as far as what we're talking with Glenn, we're just waiting to see how things go. I don't feel like there's any point in saying, hey, we're postponing this event to this date. If there really is probably not going to be an opportunity to have that date anyway. So, you know, they say sometime at the end of July, early August, things are supposedly go back to some normal, like, routine. Let's wait and see till then. for now, it's just sort of up in the air. The John Waters event we have scheduled for September 4th. Is that going to happen? I don't know. You know, I personally don't want to put these icons in, you know, in any kind of compromising position. I'd rather them not do it. I also think that they probably rather not give me my deposits back. So it's a little bit of that too. So I'm like just playing it by ear. I have no choice. You know, I rather not put John Waters, who's an older man, in front of a whole bunch of people, or Glenn, you know, he's up there in age as well. I don't want to be that guy who killed John Waters and Dance
in the same year. It was him. But it was be, the, that Lethal Mouth guy.
It might be on brand, though.
Damn him.
Told you it was no good.
Has there been an artist or personality you've wanted to reach out to do some kind of show that you haven't yet approached?
That I haven't yet approached. I'm sure there is. I mean, I have so many heroes. Who can I think off the top of my head? I mean, I'd love to do Petty Bond, but he's pretty up there, you know. We'll see. Pusshead. I absolutely love Pusshead. I have approached him, though. I'm pretty much approached everybody that I really want to. Maybe I always pronounce their name wrong, but Pierre Anguil, you know, like French photographers. Artists. I really like their stuff. I don't know. I really like Marilyn Manson's watercolors. I would love to show stuff like that. I'm trying to think. I really kind of approach everybody and circle back, and sometimes it takes years. You know, we approached everybody from David LaChapelle to Bob Gruen to you name it. I mean, G. Voucher would be a great one that I would love to do. You know, we've talked to Nick Blinko from Murder, Mary, P. and I. We've talked to Sakevi from Gizm. I mean, I've pretty much gone down every, like, I have a bucket list and I, you know, I check it and I'm like, all right, well, they're not interested. I'll check back in a year. And eventually I win them over in some way or another. And they might take a second glance and be like, oh, you've done stuff with serious people. All right, what do you have in mind? So yeah, you know, I'm just always trying to expand that and, you know, just make sure that I'm not a one-trick pony. Don't want to ever just do one thing. We get labeled a punk gallery, and I'm like, that's cute. I can appreciate that, but I don't want to be a punk gallery. I don't really know what that means. But I appreciate the sentiment. I mean, I guess it's an easy name to apply, but I don't know. I think it's limiting to call anything like that. I like to say we just do subversive stuff. You know, punk is so like, it conjures up an image in your head, and I'm like, I don't really think we're necessarily punk. I mean, we have the ethos and, you know, all of that, and certainly inspired and fascinated by it. But to just call, like, Edward Culver a punk photographer, I think is so insulting. I don't even know what that means, you know? I mean, he shot so many amazing photos, and they're like oil paintings that, you know, his composition is so incredible that you're just like, if this were anything but a photo of Minor Threat, it would be sitting in the Smithsonian. And you know what? I think actually his photos have sat in the Smithsonian. So there you go. But yeah, I just don't want it to be just one thing or feel like we're niche. Since then, you know, I kind of have enjoyed the sort of…
What was the first event that you ever did where you made money, where you didn't lose your ass? I mean, do you remember when the turning point was where you're like, holy shit, I walked away with like a few dollars?
The first Edward Culver show. Yeah. I put a lot of effort into that one though. I got to know Edward Culver from the second show we did, which was the Roz Williams show. I got in touch with him and I asked him if I could show some Christian death photo that he shot. And he's like, which one? I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, well, I have like 2,000 of them. I'm like, you do? Anyway, I went to his house. He was like, you know, grumpy guy. And, I saw all his negatives and I realized how much of the stuff that he'd never shown. And he let me pick out a photo of Roz Williams that he had never shown. So that was really fascinating to me. We sold a bunch for him that day, and that's where the rapport began. He was like, oh, cool, you sold. You gave me money. That's great. I can never sell these fucking photos. All these gothic people never wanted to spend a dime. So he was you know, I earned his trust there. And I was like, hey, would you ever let me show more of your never before seen shots? He's like, I don't know. I don't even have them scanned. I barely have them organized. It'd be a lot. It'd be really expensive. I'm like, I'll pay for it. I'm like, all right. Went to his place. He slowly started letting me look through his archives. And I was just like, holy shit. Oh my God. There's so much shit that you have that nobody would know. I mean, like, you know, hundreds of frames of like the Germs, thousands of frames of Black Flag. I mean, you fucking name it. Any band that passed through Southern California since 78 to 85, he shot. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that maybe other people ignored because they weren't so, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, like everything, like things get trendy and everyone starts only focusing on this band. But he was shooting like bands that, you know, like The Brat and Nervous Gender and things that I'm a little bit more fascinated because it's just a little bit more artsy, or it's just a very East LA history or whatever. And so anyway, I just asked him if I could just, you know, slowly start archiving it. We archived it and eventually really trusted me and started letting me leave with negatives. And we started scanning them, getting them retouched, all of that. And yeah, I put a lot of work into that first show. I think we showed 90 photos and we got a lot of people to support it. And that show brought in, I have to guess, just based on attendances from other events, something like 2,000 people through the door that night. You know, we had a line wrapped around the block, almost hitting the freeway. I mean, I was shocked and really startled because, you know, we didn't pull permits or anything like that. We don't know what the hell. I don't know what the hell I was doing. But I knew that could get me shut down and get me cited. So I was really nervous. It went over really smooth. You know, we had it really organized, surprisingly. And yeah, we made money. I mean, we sold a lot of his prints. He was flabbergasted. You know, we told him how much we made and what his cut was. He's like, I've never made this much money from my art shows. He's like, never. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, who have you shown with? He's like, Edinburgh, Morrison Hotel, you name it. Like, shown with some really prestigious places. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, I mean, it was just because I loved it. And I felt like it was a really, I don't know. I was doing the Lord's work in that sense. I'm like, these things could go in the fire one day and nobody would know that he had them.
I mean, it's really important that they're seen because I think a lot of people don't understand when you talk to when you talk about photographers that were taking photos pre-2000, mm-hmm. they were all on film for the book. That's expensive.
Super.
And so you've got negatives that aren't that are just sitting in boxes. People don't necessarily ever really took care of them.
And you know, he has photos that are very considerably 20th century icon images, you know, like the Wasted Youth flip shot or the, you know, the Okie Dog boots that Bad Religion used for their 80 to 85 album. Like those are, you know, related to an era in culture. You know, punk is now like, you know, it's almost like talking about when you talk about Black Flag, you almost are talking about Led Zeppelin. You know what I mean? It's their it's classic rock now. It's like foundation music. Like you wouldn't have Ty Segall if you didn't have these kind of bands, you know. And so you, the older these bands get, the more it becomes like, wow, they were really important historically. And only now are they being recognized by institutions, you know, Grammy Museum hosts like exhibits to X and things like that. And you're just like, it's funny, but they have no choice but to recognize it. It's culturally significant.
What are your plans for the rest of 2020 regarding your shows, your live shows, and your gallery shows?
Truly, I think everything's canceled. And in all honesty, until I feel like there's no room for conversation until there's a reason to start planning for something. You know, I think everybody's really nervous, and a lot of these. I mean, a lot of it. Most of it is self-funded here. And not that I wouldn't do the risk. I'd put the money towards whatever events that we need to do. But I just don't know if there's any point. You know, that polystyrene exhibit, I want it to happen. But if we start planning for it, I don't think it'll happen. You know, we could talk about October. We could talk about December. It doesn't matter. I really don't think it'll happen this year. And, you know, the more I hear from other people in the sort of nightlife promoting industry, like their shows aren't happening until October of 2021. And you're like, how is that fucking possible? Like, we don't have anything on the calendar in our venue, in our company until October of 2021. I'm like, that's ridiculous.
I mean, LA has become small town America like that.
Mm-hmm.
And small town America, I've been there. It fucking sucks.
Yeah.
And this is like the biggest tease.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right there, right outside of our window. And you can't do anything.
You know what I am going to do that? I don't know if it's meaningful or worthwhile or whatever, but at least for the show that we currently have up, I'm gonna test the waters with it. But I want to get it a 3D mapped, like 360 mapped. And you could do an online digital tour of it, you know, and it'll be interactive. Or like if you like, you know, like Google Maps, basically.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So when you walk up to a piece, you can like click on the little icon and Matt Skiba will be like, hey, this is my piece. It's called Third Wheel. I don't know. I was like having a moment. You know, he'll have some anecdote about it. And I think that's probably the coolest thing that you could do in a digital age, because every time somebody – promotes like a digital art show or digital art fair, I just like roll my eyes and I'm like, that's so boring. I don't want to go look at that.
I think that would be pretty cool. The show here is great. I love it. It Matt Skiba has, you know, you always see that a lot of musicians will then transition or try to transition. I mean, George Bush did it into art, right?
I would love to show his art.
And you always never know what to expect, but I think his really captures, you know, the essence of Alkaline Trio and his sort of persona in that band.
I think a lot of the things that we do focus on are musicians that have an art background, like a fundamental art background. You know, when we showed Nick Zinner's photography, you know, he went to art school for photography before he ever joined Yeah Yeah Yes. It just, he never got to really see that career blossom because his band exploded. Same thing with Daniel Ash. You know, they all met in art school. All of Bauhaus were art school kids. Their art school really didn't get to be used. You know, their band took off. So many. And Matt Skiba has a background in art as well. So, I mean, it might seem like low-hanging fruit or kind of like a gimmicky thing that we do. We show a lot of musicians' artwork, but all of them have had a real fundamental art background or focused on it for a really long time. You know, when we showed Poor Old Thompson's artwork from The Cure, not that many people realize it, but all of those quirky little designs on all those Cure album covers, weird little starfishes and the swirls and all that, that's all his stuff, you know? And it ends up being very... it's pop art at that point, you know. You can recognize those weird little swirls and happy faces and you're like, oh, that's from the Wish album or whatever. So I don't know. I think it's interesting to hear how a lot of these people's like life journey began and where they're at now. It's like, did Matt Skiba think he was going to be, you know, playing stadiums with Blink-182? Probably not. I'm sure he was just like, you know, a weird kid listening to punk that wanted to go to art school to do something creative. I think that's all we all, like most of us think about, you know, like, I don't know how I fit in the adult world, but maybe art school could be something I could consider. So I don't know. I think that's an interesting, it's an interesting look at musicians and their creative lens. You know, it usually was developed from something else, oftentimes anyway. Quarantine, quarantine.